This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, what is it that makes our planet home? Zooming way out to celebrate Earth Day. And what ancient architecture can tell us about the earliest democracies. But first, data centers have been a hot topic in Maine this week. These centers, which are increasingly needed to support the AI industry, are controversial. They use a lot of power and water, and they can drive up electricity costs. The state's House and Senate passed an 18-month moratorium on data center construction. It would have been the first statewide ban, but Maine's Governor Janet Mills vetoed the plan, citing concerns about jobs. Here to break it all down is Pete McGuire, climate reporter at Maine Public Radio. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so what were the details of this data center ban that was passed by Maine's legislature?
So what they had proposed was an 18-month pause on all data center construction above 20 megawatts and the development of this coordinating council full of experts and government officials and utilities and other interested parties that would kind of come up with rules of the road and regulations for developing these facilities in the future.
So Maine's governor vetoed this. Do we know why?
One of the main sticking points for the governor was this project in Jay that it's a town really near her hometown. You know, it's a place that she knows really well. And local officials there were kind of embracing this $550 million project that would bring in jobs and some economic development and rehabilitate or reused, rather, an old paper mill that closed down a few years ago. This is an area that's kind of been economically struggling since then. That was a big blow to the economy in the region. And people see this as a way to inject some money, some tax revenue, and potentially some jobs into the area. The governor found this to be a really sticking point. She asked for an exemption to the bill for this project specifically that didn't make it. And that was a big part of her decision making, I would imagine.
How did the legislation originate?
It originated with this council firstly, and then it kind of morphed into a moratorium. Data centers have not been an issue in Maine. It just happened maybe in the last 6 months that these projects started popping up. And legislators kind of thought, well, even though electricity is really expensive in Maine, we have a cooler climate. Some people say that's really good for data centers. It saves on cooling costs and things like that. But let's get ahead of this because we've seen what's happened in the rest of the country and we've seen how upset people are getting about this and how data centers can influence increasing electric bills and the environmental concerns you mentioned about them. So let's get ahead of this, make sure they're done properly when they come here.
So it originated with this council, but what about Mainers themselves? Has there been vocal opposition from the citizens of Maine?
Yeah, in two cases. In one case, this development came forward as kind of a fully fledged package with a tax break. This was in the city of Lewiston, and it kind of got plunked on the desk of the city council, and people were really, really upset, and there was almost immediate backlash. And the city council immediately voted unanimously to cancel that project. Another one in a smaller coastal town, people didn't know about it until they found out through some filings that the town council was doing about this. So people feel like these are being developed in secret. They don't know about them until it's too late. And that has really increased opposition to data centers in the state.
Is there opposition to this ban?
There is. Most Republicans in the state legislature voted against this, with the idea, the argument being Maine has enough regulations. There are ways that we could regulate these facilities without having a moratorium. We don't need this council to make new rules specific to these. And because there are places in the state that could maybe benefit from smaller data centers, places that need some economic development, could do with the tax base and whatever, small jobs might be brought there.
Why do you think Maine is out front on this?
I think, like I said before, part of it has to do with the fact that we're last. This hasn't been a boom, you know? I mean, this hasn't been boom times like it has been in Northern Virginia, Texas, Oregon, Arizona, places like that, you know, where this has been going on for years and now we're kind of seeing the backlash. I think people who are in favor of this moratorium are saying we have a chance here to get out in front of this and not end up like places where this has gone wrong.
Pete McGuire, climate reporter at Maine Public Radio. Thanks for filling us in today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Maine isn't the only state grappling with data center construction. There are heated conversations happening in legislatures and community meetings across the country, like that clip you just heard from Franklin County, Missouri. But is community pushback stopping data center expansion, and how will that shape the future of this technology? Joining me to talk about that is Lauren Keeler, an associate professor and director of the Just Energy Transition Center at Arizona State University. Lauren, thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Outside of Maine, where are we seeing pushback from communities?
Well, I'm here in Arizona, and we've seen organized opposition, you know, most prominently to Project Blue in Tucson. There have been opposition to data centers proposed in Louisiana. You know, Virginia is where we've got a very large cluster, but we're even seeing opposition there. Opposition's mounted in Illinois. There's really been a push to expand data center infrastructure nationwide in response to expanding use of AI. And as that expansion continues, opposition grows.
And what's driving the opposition?
I think most of the opposition is directly related to these very large, very energy and resource intensive infrastructure projects right next door to people's homes. I think folks are rightly not convinced that the presence of data centers in your community directly benefits community members, and they're aware of some of the negative impacts now that data centers have grown in their quantity and people are talking about it. So they can be noisy, they're very large, folks are concerned about their utility rates going up. All of those are giving people pause and, you know, inviting the question, why would we want this?
The argument that's sometimes made is that data centers bring jobs. Is that true?
Not directly. So the greatest jobs associated with data centers is going to be in their construction. For a very large data center, you could see 1,000 jobs associated with the construction of data centers. But when that data center is done being constructed and it's in operation, you're going to have dozens of jobs, maybe 100. And so the jobs are not commensurate with the resource impact. And that's why we really encourage communities that are interested in hosting data centers to go the extra mile and ask for additional benefits from those data centers.
Such as?
Data centers can do revenue sharing. So communities could ask for a percentage of the profits to be paid into a fund that goes directly to public works or to education, so that as data centers are financially successful, the communities next to them are financially successful as well. I also think safeguards against environmental pollution, overuse of water resources, the price of energy going up, all of those can be provisions that are built into an agreement with data center operators that protect neighboring communities.
You know, with data center legislation popping up in different places, where are data centers ending up? Like, do you think this is an equity issue?
Legislation is fragmented, right? We're not seeing federal legislation. And so data center operators are really interested in getting up and running. And so they're going to go to places where it is easier to get a data center. And so you are seeing impacts of organized opposition on where data centers are being located. Data centers right now, you know, we have clusters in areas that have previously hosted them where there's been a need. So you have a cluster in Virginia that supports the defense industry. You have a cluster in the Northwest that supports the tech industry, the aerospace industry around Seattle. Increasingly, we have a cluster here in Arizona that's supporting chip manufacturing. But yes, the lack of a federal legislation creates geographic fragmentation and puts the burden on communities to advocate for themselves when a data center operator is looking to locate there.
Mm. You know, you've done a lot of work on the green energy transition. How does the pushback around data centers compare to wind farms or solar farms?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense of not in my backyard. I think that is parallel. One of the things that, you know, I think is similar. You know, we've seen in Arizona, for example, a moratorium on solar development in the western part of the state. And what we heard from communities that lived there was, hey, you're taking out this big swath of desert and you're sending the power to LA and Phoenix. Where's the benefit for us? Right. So what communities are asking with these data centers is, hey, listen, this isn't because of my phone and my use. This is because of, you know, AI use by some company. Where's the benefit for me when I have to live next door to this huge, hot, loud facility?
Are there ripple effects from data center construction beyond the sort of immediate effects of, you know, sound or electricity prices going up? Like, do they require whole new power plants to power them?
Yeah, I mean, the greatest impact is going to be on the electricity system. Here in Arizona, the demand queue for new power to be added to our energy system over the next 10 years is as large as as much power as they have added to the energy system in the last 50.
Wow.
So none of that can be met without new generation. So I think one of the risks associated with data centers is this rapid expansion of electricity infrastructure, new power plants, new transmission, and the cost of that getting passed on to your average utility customer. And so it's really important that utilities make provisions and work with data centers so that it's those data centers that are paying for the cost of that infrastructure expansion. That's not the default.
Do you feel like there's a way to do this right for communities and data centers to coexist?
I do think that. I also think not every community is right for a data center. You know, if you have really scarce water resources, if it's really hard to develop renewable energy that can power these data centers, if you're in a place that has environmental hazards, maybe data centers aren't right. But I do think that for certain communities, you can develop data centers in a way that provides direct benefit to the people that are adjacent to those facilities.
Lauren Keeler, an associate professor and director of the Just Energy Transition Center at Arizona State University. Lauren, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me and having this conversation.
We have to take a break. And when we come back, in honor of Earth Day, thinking about some of the things that allowed this planet to become our home. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Think back to earlier in the month when the Artemis II astronauts sent back those spectacular pictures from their trip around the moon. You know, there were a couple of shots of Earth that really made us think of Carl Sagan's comments on the pale blue dot. That's home. That's us. And with this being Earth Week, happy Earth Week to all who celebrate, we thought it'd be a good chance to get the big picture, the really big picture. What makes Earth so special, and why are we here at all? Joining me now is astrophysicist Hakeem Olusheyi. He's author of Why Do We Exist? The Nine Realms of the Universe That Make You Possible. Welcome back, Hakeem.
Thank you so much for having me.
We love having you. I have to say, what I loved about your book is that you broke my concept of what's needed for life. Like, you took me way beyond atmosphere, water. So I want to start big. If you're a universe, how do you build a place where we can live? I'm guessing you need a sun, right?
You need a sun. And for a sun, you need these giant clouds of hydrogen. This is the sole source material from which new stars are made. They're called giant molecular clouds, and they're light years across, and they birth, you know, hundreds and thousands of stars. But they themselves must come from somewhere. And, you know, it's a huge coincidence that, you know, we have this little thing called a proton and a thing called an electron that just happen to have, even though they're so different one from the other, equal and opposite electric charges. And so, you know, if electrons didn't exist, every proton in the universe would try to get as far apart from every other proton as possible. But when they bond with an electron, they can be gathered into these gargantuan clouds and then birth stars.
Okay, so you've got these big clouds, and then like the matter collects, right? It's like kind of like dust bunnies.
Yeah, it's kind of like dust bunnies. And, you know, there's a player in the scheme that doesn't get a lot of attention, and that's called turbulence. Inside these clouds, you get these knots of denser material, and turbulence makes them swirl and concentrate, and they form these long filaments that break up into clumps, that break up into cores, that eventually try to form stars.
Wow. Okay, so that miracle happens. You've got a sun. Now we need a planet.
Yes.
How did we get this one?
Well, in a way, you can say that we're made from the residue of the residue of the residue, right?
That sounds right, Hakeem. You know, just knowing us.
Because in the early universe, what happens is when matter comes into existence, it's almost equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And when matter and antimatter meet, just like in the power system for the Starship Enterprise, the matter-antimatter conversion chamber, those two matter particles cease to exist. Their mass is converted into energy in a process called annihilation. And for every billion particles, there was one matter particle left over. And that's what we're made from. And then when you get to the level of the universe as a whole, matter that we know of is only about 5% of all that exists. 95% is the real universe, right? We're that leftover 5. And in the same way, when a star forms, there's residual matter left over that forms a disk around that star. And again, the forces of electromagnetism, like dust bunnies, begin to pull particles together. And then they begin to collide and grow. And eventually you have dozens of protoplanets orbiting that star that then begin to collide and grow even more. And hopefully the system settles down. You have your planet orbiting your star. And now, if everything is right, you're ready to seed life.
Yeah, but like this was another big aha. Like it's pretty hard to get everything right. And I think, you know, we pay a lot of attention to things like temperature and the presence of liquid water. But there are all these other amenities that make Earth real estate valuable.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk to us about them.
Absolutely. So your star needs to be in the right part of the galaxy to form life, right? In our galaxy, there's this 4 million solar mass, supermassive black hole at the core of the galaxy, and all galaxies have these supermassive black holes. So, you know, those areas aren't safe. So you have to be far enough away. And scientists have studied what percentage of our stars are in what we call the galactic habitable zone. And for the Milky Way, it turns out to be only 1.2%.
And because we're not even talking about like how close you are to your sun, right?
No, we're talking about where your sun is located within its galaxy, if it can be.
Yeah.
Yes, if it can be safe.
Okay, beyond location, 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 you talk about some other special features that are required, like the magnetosphere, which I haven't given a lot of thought to.
Yes, the magnetosphere is, again, an unsung hero in our story. So we're lucky on Earth because we have this three-layer filter that not only allowed life to thrive, but allowed life to leave the oceans and come onto land. So what is that three-layer filter? First, you have our atmosphere, which in itself is an anomaly. Then you have, in our atmosphere, an ozone layer. Again, powered by life. Without life, there would be no ozone layer, but you needed billions of years of simple photosynthetic oxygen-producing life to have an ozone layer. But extremely importantly, you wouldn't have the atmosphere if we didn't have our planet's powerful magnetic field. And that's what sets us apart from Venus and Mars. Because when we look around the universe, when we look around our galaxy, when we look around our solar system, atmospheres typically come in one of two configurations, super thick or absent or completely absent, just no atmosphere. But here is Earth with this super thin atmosphere that allows the life-giving light in, but repels the damaging radiation that would make life on Earth impossible. And not only that, that very same radiation would have done to Earth what it did to Mars, and that is erode our atmosphere away such that life could not exist on the surface of our planet.
And that magnetosphere is because of how the planet was formed, right?
That is correct. Early in Earth's formation, it was struck by a Mars-sized body that we've given the name Theia, And instead of our core settling down and becoming layered and with the denser stuff in the middle and less dense stuff as you go out, like what happened with Venus, that collision stirred up our core of our planet. And the result today is that there is not solid ground completely under your feet from the surface of the Earth down to the core. Our planet is more like a lava cake, right? We have a molten liquid outer core, which I don't think people appreciate. It's like we have a solid inner core. You could think of that as like a large nut surrounded by molten chocolate, surrounded by the mantle and the crust. So maybe
you're speaking my language. Thank you.
That's right. Galactus would find Earth incredibly delicious. So because of that molten core, that molten outer core, where it interfaces with the mantle, there is a big temperature difference. The mantle is cooler. The outer core is hotter. So that means that heat wants to flow. And just like a convection oven or a convection heater in your home, that stirs up that molten core. And when you have liquid metals flowing, they create magnetic fields. And that liquid outer core creates the strong magnetic field of Earth. And it would not exist had we not had that massive collision with Theia.
Let's talk about life itself forming. Yes. You know, I feel like we've all heard about the building blocks of life, but you also call out some other important ingredients like having a cell membrane.
Yes.
Why is that so important?
Well, life needs to do the opposite of what the rest of the universe is doing. And that is, life needs to create organization, and life needs to create energy gradients such that instead of spreading energy out, it concentrates it. And in order to do that, it needs to separate itself from the rest of the universe. And so the cell membrane, which on Earth are these fatty molecules that we call lipids that have this particular property that one half of them likes water and the other half doesn't. So when they are in water, they arrange themselves in little spheres so that the side that does not like water is on the inside and the side that does is on the outside. So now you have this separate compartment from the universe in which chemical reactions can take place. And some of those chemical reactions are involving these organic molecules. And the thing again, I will say it again, we find these organic molecules on asteroids, comets, in gas clouds. They're everywhere.
So they can spontaneously assemble. That's the idea.
They do spontaneously assemble. And not only that, the important organic molecule that we call RNA, experiment after experiment after experiment shows that they also will spontaneously form under the right conditions of energy and temperature and, being in a nice little compartment.
Okay, but here's where I get stuck. So how do we go from a water bag with a shell,
yeah,
with some complex molecules inside of it, to like a cell that has organelles that do jobs?
Well, there's one step in that process that we call abiogenesis that is a Nobel Prize waiting for someone to figure out exactly
Listeners,
that process.
Get on it. Abiogenesis, what is that?
That is the step where you go from non-living inanimate matter to actually living reproducing matter.
Is this like where physical principles meet natural selection? You know what I mean? Like, I guess I'm wondering why molecules tend to reproduce themselves.
You know, there are examples of, you know, non-living matter reproducing itself. The simplest example is a crystal, right? Crystals reproduce themselves. We take advantage of that when we grow the silicon wafers that we use for our electronics. But the process of, if you think about the nature of life, it's both stable and unstable. It's stable in the sense that a cell can last for a long time. But in order to reproduce, it has to split in half, right? So that's the instability side of it. And so if you think about a situation like at a black smoker, these volcanic vents at the bottom of the ocean, you have hot water coming out of the vent, and then you have cold water surrounding it. So you could imagine that such a cell, while in the cold water, will be stable, But when it hits the hot water, it may break apart, right? So these are the very sort of environments that we think early life may have started. And that's just an example of how you can use temperature differences to have that stable yet unstable property. But in terms of that first cell that decided, hey, I'm going to do metabolism. I'm going to split in half and make a copy of myself. I don't know what the foremost leading authorities know, because I'm not one of them on that topic. But as far as I know, I have no idea how that step took place.
I feel better. You know, Hakeem, the thing I felt reading your book was just like how profoundly miraculous it is that I'm here at all, that you and I are having this conversation right now. You know, it just seems so improbable. I don't know. My mind can't really even hold it.
You know, I see it as improbable, but inevitable, because the universe does things in big numbers, right?
You know,
our galaxy has 400 billion stars or so, and there's hundreds of billions of galaxies in the observable universe alone. And so, you know, if you look at many of the steps necessary, the universe creates greater and greater complexity as it evolves. That's just what it does. And so we are a step on that complexity ladder. So it seems to me that the step of creating those early cells is about potential. And once you have that potential, you have that possibility. And given the large numbers of planets and stars and galaxies, it becomes an inevitability.
I mean, I get that. And I don't mean to say that, like, I think I'm so special. I guess I just feel like it's unlikely that me, little old me, is here having these thoughts. Like, what are the odds?
Well, I calculate the odds for having multicellular life, but not an intelligent, technologically advanced civilization. Because I think that if you have the simple life, yes, getting to multicellular life is almost an inevitability. But how you go from there to large multicellular life and then to intelligence, that is where you need that water bathed in sunlight. And not every, most places where you have life, that's not going to happen. And even if you have large multicellular life, it still took 500 million years for us to get humans that are technologically advanced. So I think you and me having this conversation as humans with language, oh man, that's incredibly rare. That is incredibly rare. But when it comes to multicellular life planets orbiting stars, I calculate that it's like one out of a million in our galaxy. So there should be about 100,000 stellar systems in our galaxy that have multicellular complex life.
Amazing. Before we go, you write a lot about imagination.
Yes.
And I loved that. What do you think the role of imagination is in science?
Imagination is our superpower, especially when we employ our hive mind and bring multiple imaginations together. Before anyone can do anything, they have to first imagine it, right? You have to sit there, whether it's mathematically, whether it's building an experiment, whether it's deciding where to look in the universe, right? We have the ability to imagine things that have never existed in the universe. And if you look, go all the way back to Galileo, he realized that, yeah, what we accept is true only is, it must be consistent with what we observe to be true. But in order to, and when I say observe, I mean in our experiments and our observations, but in order to get to the deepest truths of the universe, we need to imagine things that we could never do experimentally. So our imaginations are the gateway to the future and to the greatest truths that the universe has to offer.
Happy Earth Week, Hakeem.
Thank you so much. You as well, Flora.
Astrophysicist Hakeem Olusheyi is author of Why Do We Exist? The Nine Realms of the Universe That Make You Possible. And you can read an excerpt from the book at sciencefriday.com/exist. Speaking of Earth Week, we recently got a call from a listener about other planetary issues.
Hello, my name is Andrew. I'm calling from Sacramento, California. Was just finishing listening to the episode titled Should Pluto Be a Planet Again? And one thing I noticed that the scientists, they called it Mother Nature as far as the formation of the planets and how their surfaces are and things like that. It's very rare that I hear people refer to Mother Nature in reference to other planets, other than Earth, which I really liked because Mother Nature is the universe, not just Earth. It's a nice reminder. So thanks for that.
Thank you for calling us, Andrew. Our listener line is always open for your thoughts. We love hearing from you. 877-4-SCI-FRI is our number. 877-4-SCI-FRI. After the break, what the design of ancient cities can tell us about the earliest democracies. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Today we are hitting the streets, the dusty, ancient streets, looking for clues about the origins of democracy. Researchers writing in the journal Science Advances explain how the design of ancient temples, plazas, cities can tell us how a civilization was governed. So what does ancient architecture reveal about democracy, and do the democratic design principles hold true today? Here to chip away at some of these big questions is Dr. Jake Holland-Lulowitz, anthropologist and assistant professor at the Pennsylvania State University. Hey, Jake, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
What does democratic design or democratic architecture look like?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if we can call the architecture democratic, but it certainly reflects kind of ethos and our institutions, which themselves are democratic. And so when we're thinking of democracy, I think what we're thinking of are places that are inclusive, that can hold a lot of people, that are designed to facilitate deliberation and conversation.
Give me some examples from the sites that you looked at.
Sure. At least where I work in southeastern North America, we're looking for big, huge, round structures. You know, they're much bigger than a house, right? They can fit more than one important family. Maybe they can fit everyone in the village. Maybe they can fit family representatives from lots of villages coming together. And the shape, the circle is really important too, because when you're sitting in a circle and we find evidence for benches around the walls, you can see everyone else, right? No one is necessarily front and center, right? It's not like a classroom where all of my students are looking at me and I'm telling them stuff that they maybe need to know. But it really reflects basic logic of decision-making, in that deliberation and consensus being more important than top-down action.
What about plazas or like the big piazza? How do you read that?
Yeah. Plazas are really interesting. And I think they're really complex too, because they can serve, I think, lots of different purposes. I work on societies who are the descendants of the Muscogee Creek Nation. And square grounds are, center to social and political life. They're where people gather to reaffirm, relationships and strengthen bonds between people and eat great food. And looking at things like the size of plazas, again, can tell us, who's meant to be in that space. How many people are meant to get together? Is the whole village around the plaza, or is the plaza associated maybe with a palace, right? Mm. Which could maybe tell us something different about what the purpose of this open space is, right?
Yeah, I know I'm getting into the dusty details here, but like, is it a correlation? Like you see, round buildings and open plazas that are not associated with a palace with democracies? Or is it that you're like, oh, these kinds of spaces tell us that there were democratic principles at play?
Yeah, I think they certainly are a great feature for us to identify and begin, as archaeologists, begin to interpret these societies as more collectively or democratically oriented. On their own, they don't tell us everything, but I think they're really great hints.
Mm. And what about on the flip side? Is there architecture that suggests autocratic government?
Yeah. Well, I think it looks like, number one, it looks like the absence of those kind of big spaces that can fit a huge percentage of the population. And is the prominence and centrality of palaces, it may be things like the, you know, wildly unproportional size of a ruler's house compared to everyone else in the society's house. Those are the kinds of things we might look for to start making an argument that maybe this isn't the most collective or bottom-up, you know, decision-making system that we have going on here.
How would the White House read?
This is interesting. I was actually thinking about this morning because, you know, I think if we just found the White House, we might say, well, actually, we might say a few things. We might say, oh, the guy who lives there, he has a lot of power, right? And this is not unlike how archaeologists have approached the past in many ways, right? We find a big pyramid or a huge palace maybe, and we're like, wow, they have a lot of power, right? But once we start maybe looking broader and kind of contextualizing this, right, we find like, hey, right down the road from this White House, there's actually a much larger building and it has way more seats. And, you know, this is the same where I work in the Southeast where, okay, we have maybe earthen mounds where there may be important people living on top of them. But, you know, right next to the mound, there's a big round structure. And so we find, you know, with the White House, obviously we know about our system of governance. We know it's based on checks and balances and these different arms of the government. And we actually find those same kinds of checks and balances in the archaeological record too.
Yeah, in theory. In theory, that's...
Yeah.
Okay, so you looked at over 30 places. Did you have big take-homes about the origins of democracy or how it was practiced?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think maybe for a lot of people in other disciplines and even the public, I think what we found is really exciting and really fun. And I think really hopeful, too.
Hit us. Hit us with some
hope. We found that, you know, democracy has really deep roots, right? It's not a modern invention. You know, the Greeks may have come up with particular kinds of institutions and particular forms of collective governance. But all over the world, societies everywhere have figured this out, right? We find examples, at least in our paper, for democracies in Asia, democracies in North America, democracies in Mesoamerica and Central America. And alternatively, we find autocracies in all those places, including places like Europe, right? And I think we could take this farther. And in the paper, we cite this quote from Applebaum where they note that, you know, autocracy isn't a genetic trait. It's culture and language and religion. They don't produce autocracy or democracy, right? No person or nation is condemned, you know, to autocracy just by, you know, their nature of geography or religion. And the flip side of that is that no nation is guaranteed democracy, right? We have to work really hard at it. But I think the archaeological record shows that people have always worked really hard at this and have been really successful at it.
Well, which came first? I mean, does design for, you know, people being in a collective lead to democracy, or does democracy determine design?
I think the design is purposeful and it's meant to facilitate an idea of a system. I approach these kinds of things as, you know, why was this structure built? Like, what was happening at this time? Like, why is it now? Where I work in the southeastern United States, you know, the earliest council houses are we've dated them in central Georgia, and they seem to pop up at a time and begin to be used at a time when there's migration happening. So you have immigrants coming into this region from far away. And the argument that I've been trying to make and making is that council houses and deliberative collective governance was a response. Like, that was the solution to now living with new families and people with different ideas, you know, instead of defaulting towards the easy, you know, the quote unquote easy route of autocracy, you know, they decided, like, we're going to you know, build new institutions as a response to immigration and population growth and living with diverse peoples in our community. And the way we're going to make sure that this works and the way that we're going to be able to quell tension is through deliberation and consensus.
That's a hopeful note to end on.
Like I said, I like to come at a lot of this as like very hopeful.
Look, I'm never going to look at a circular building the same way. So thank you.
Excellent.
Dr. Jake Holland Lulowitz is an anthropologist and assistant professor at the Pennsylvania State University. Moving from ancient cities to modern ones, what role does design play in democracies today? Do those ancient design principles hold true? Joining me now is Dr. Jeff Howe, head of the architecture department at the National University of Singapore. Hey, Jeff, thanks for talking today.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to join.
Do you feel like the role of public space in democracy has changed over time? I mean, how do you think about it now as compared to, you know, what we were talking about, which was thousands of years ago?
Yeah. No, I think the role of public space is still critical to democracy. If we look at how democracy works, right? So people have to express their opinion. They need to gather. They need to communicate. Need to engage in debate. They need to kind of make their presence known to the state. And so public space still play that traditional role. But it's just that public space now does not just include the actual physical space. It also includes, you know, the online forum, the social media. So there's a whole other realm of public space that is exists kind of virtually, online, on your device, and they are today just as powerful as the actual physical space, and in some way, you know, became even more prevalent in terms of how, you know, people talk to each other, how they are connected to each other. So it has become more complicated. And also the technology has allowed authoritarian state to, you know, monitor people in the public space, right? Oftentimes space come with surveillance. So even though the space may be there, people are not able to gather. And so we're at a moment, an interesting kind of historical moment in which we're experiencing this kind of disconnect between space and what they're meant to perform, and then how democracy work both in physical realm and in the online kind of realm. And that's the whole kind of purpose of kind of public space become sort of diminished.
Well, what's that like for an architect? Because I assume you are interested in the physical.
Oh, absolutely. I think the physical space is still absolutely important. And we have seen in recent, you know, protest movement that, you know, the actual gathering still matters. But a lot of times those gatherings are either facilitated by, you know, social media, your digital device, and also at the same time, the same kind of digital infrastructure can also stop people from gathering. So, for example, the state can just shut down the internet, and that stops people from communicating with each other. And so things are more complicated today.
When you're traveling, can you read a new place to figure out any clues about the values of that, of that society?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you can look at how elaborate buildings are, which is an indication of how the society kind of value the importance of that particular building. If you go to Tokyo, you know, obviously there's a history of the imperial presence. You know, the center of the city is still the palace, right? So we can read into the history of the city in terms of what it used to be. You know, before it became a democracy, you can travel to Beijing, Tiananmen Square. You know, you can understand the history of the place, and then at the same time, the square is still there. but it's not a functioning democracy, right? These places do tell stories, and you know, stories from the past, from the present, and where things are going, and they're really fascinating to look at.
That's so fascinating. I mean, what are the modern, in modern autocratic societies, is there telltale architecture? Is it just cameras? What do you look for?
Yeah, so it's hard to tell now. So this is, so the line has blurred between, you know, what the, so the appearance and how spaces actually function, right? So if you, you know, go to a Chinese city, for example, you know, they, is just as vibrant and colorful, in some way even more vibrant and colorful than a lot of cities in sort of liberal democracy, right? But it doesn't suggest how the spaces are actually governed, right? And so there's a kind of disconnect between sort of the appearance of spaces and then, you know, how they actually function in the, you know, active democracy. And this is, you know, where, you know, how, like, the state can control a narrative, how they can control what people remembers, what people know. And so I think I'll come back to, again, the question of democracy is that, you know, a public space, a functioning public space is where these kind of story can be told. And that required not just the actual physical artifact, but also the actual conversation, right? People speaking up about what might have been, you know, marginalized, what might have been forgotten. And so the actual speech, I think, is still critical. And this is, I think, where we need to be concerned with, you know, when things have been erased, people are being marginalized, and stories are not being told.
That's a great point. And I think it's really interesting because it suggests that, you know, even if a space looks a certain way, like mm-hmm. it's colorful or welcoming or democratic looking, you have to ask yourself who's the author of that story and what is the story they're trying to tell.
Absolutely.
Dr. Jeff Howe, head of the architecture department at the National University of Singapore. Thank you for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including Jessica Wright, who has been making these awesome social videos. Please check them out. You can follow SciFry on all the platforms. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And if you missed any part of the show, please subscribe to our podcast. It's daily. It's free. It's on every platform. Just search for Science Friday. Thank you for listening. I'm Flora Lichtman.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, your DNA is mutating right now. We'll explain why that could actually be a good thing. Plus, celebrating Earth Week with some of our favorite poets. They'll share tips on how to process the tiny moments in nature. But first, in early April, all eyes were on the moon, right? With the lunar flyby of the Artemis space mission. And they got an unprecedented view of the lunar far side. But researchers are working to put eyes on the far side of the moon in another way, by delivering a tiny radio telescope there. It's called Lucy Knight, and joining me to talk about it is Anja Slosar, science lead for the mission. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, thank you very much.
Anja, describe this little radio telescope for me, if you will.
Okay, so we're putting like a small Pathfinder radio telescope called Lucy Knight on the lunar far side. And it's really, it's a pathfinder. It's the simplest thing you can imagine that can receive radio signals from the outer space. So people have been dreaming about putting radio telescope on the moon because the moon has this special property. Then on the far side of the moon, you're at the same time shielded from the Earth and shielded from the sun. And that's supposed to make it one of the best observatories for the radio frequency observations in the entire solar system, okay? And especially so at the very low frequencies, where basically observations from the ground are very, very difficult. If you go below 50 megahertz, observations from the ground, basically it's like looking up from the bottom of the swimming pool. Everything is blurred. It's a total mess.
So I should not be picturing this big, giant Arecibo-type radio dish. We're talking about a demonstration project, a little project, right?
Yeah, it's a little project. It's basically calling a telescope, in some sense, it's a misnomer, right? It has essentially four antennas, the four stick antennas like your portable radio. It's really more kind of radio receiver. It's like FM receiver you have at home, but kind of slightly lower frequency and can kind of see all the frequencies at the same time. So it will make very, very blurry pictures of the sky that we can then reconstruct to then turn into kind of like a low resolution map of how the sky looks like at these frequencies. However, having said that, it will be the first time in the history of humanity we're actually able to make any maps at this very, very low frequency.
Now, there's been talk that it can see something called the Dark Ages signal. What is that?
Yeah, so Dark Ages signal, it's something very exciting. I would call it like a platonic ideal, or something where the field is going towards, something they want to see in, I would say, 50 years. So Lucy Knight will not see it, but it's a pathfinder for seeing Dark Ages, okay? So Dark Ages refers to this particular epoch in the evolution universe where kind of this initial hot plasma, this soup of protons, electrons, and so on, has kind of cooled down enough that we have just neutral hydrogen and nothing more. And it's because it's so early that we have no stars have already turned on. This is a very, very pristine universe, right? Which we can explain just using fundamental physics, like general relativity, atomic physics, thermodynamics, stuff like that. We can make extremely precise predictions. Because once the stars turn on and you get galaxies and planets and so on, universe becomes a very complicated place. It's like weather. But before the stars turn on, if you could measure that epoch, you could really make some really fundamental measurement of the universe. Now, unfortunately, as I said, Lucy Knight will not see Dark Ages because they are kind of foregrounds, which are much brighter than this thing from our own galaxy and other galaxies shining. But it will kind of enable us to basically demonstrate that the far side of the moon is really as good as a place to make observations that people think it is, right? People have been thinking it's the best place to make these measurements, but nobody has actually done it.
Is this sort of seen as a way to pave the way for future radio telescopes on the far side of the moon?
For sure. Basically, Lucy Knight, it's a pathfinder, and we're already thinking about where to go next. And the natural way is to build up so-called interferometers, where you kind of put many individual elements of a radio telescope and kind of combine those signals so they start acting like a big dish. However, you know, you eat the elephant in small pieces, so that's why we start with small Pathfinder. And if it works, you will learn a lot about how to make these observations, how to survive the lunar night, how to operate the telescope, what the big problems are. There's still fundamental unknowns, like, you know, maybe they're micrometeorites. Maybe Moon has like weak ionosphere that is going to make our observation difficult. You know, Lucy Knight will kind of try to understand. And that's paved the way for bigger instruments in the future.
Are you hoping to be able to see these Dark Age signals or not?
With Lucy Knight, I don't think we'll be able to see a Dark Age signal unless something really surprising happens. Having said that, because this is such an unexplored part of the radio frequency spectrum, maybe there will be other surprises. You know, there are people who think maybe cosmic microwave background is very bright at these very low frequencies. Maybe there is new dark matter physics or some new other fundamental physics that will produce kind of interesting new spectral lines or features in the maps or in frequency space. You know, there are very, very, very few parts of modern science where kind of things are unknown at this level of precision, okay? So that's what makes it really exciting.
That is sounding exciting. So how do you get to the far side of the moon?
So we get to the far side of the moon on board of a lander, which is paid by CLIPS. CLIPS is the NASA Commercial Lunar Payload Services. Basically, it's a way for NASA to develop like an ecosystem of private sector providers that can take you to the moon and land you there. And basically, we have like DHL to the moon. And we are one of the early landers from this program. We will be on the Blue Ghost 2. You might remember Blue Ghost 1 successfully landed on the lunar near side last year. It was the first successful landing by a private sector company on the moon. And that's why it makes us very, very hopeful, because we'll be essentially using the same lander, but on the lunar far side. Landing is essentially autonomous, so in principle, it's not that difficult whether you're on this side or the other side. One thing is that because you are outside of direct field of view from the ground, you have to rely on the relay satellite that kind of bounces the signals from the Earth so you can actually communicate back to Earth. And this adds clearly a layer of complexity. We'll see. Fingers right. crossed we land and our instrument works.
And what's the timeline on this?
So we're still talking about the launch being slated for the end of 2026. It might get delayed. Nobody knows. Like in space business, things often get delayed. But I think, you know, I can't wait to get there and see.
Well, the Chinese were the first to land a vessel on the far side and return samples. You're looking to be the first to put a telescope there.
Yeah, and there will be many, many firsts in this mission. It will be the first U.S. mission to land on the far side. It will be the first private sector mission to land on the far side. It will be the first functioning radio telescope on the far side. Chinese also had like an instrument that unfortunately didn't work very well, and we're trying to kind of not repeat similar mistakes. It will be the first commercial instrument trying to survive the lunar night, which is very difficult, right? So moon is extremely difficult to survive both the day and night, because during the day it's very, very hot, and during the night it's very, very cold. And so you have to design for two very different thermal environments.
Well, I have a practical question for you. If it's on the far side of the moon, and the moon is always facing away from the Earth, how do you get your signals back to Earth?
So there is a satellite that circles around the moon. And if it's far away, it can be simultaneously in the view of your instrument on the far side and the Earth. But mostly, it basically, when it's on the far side, it talks to our lucinite. And when it goes around, it talks to the ground. And this kind of allows us to kind of transfer our data back, right? But this, for example, puts like an interesting level of complexity, because the total amount of volume you can transfer, it's quite low. We hope to transfer about 6 gigabytes of data for every lunar cycle, 28 days. And so one could almost email this data.
Right? I'm fascinated about how you got this idea. How did this project get started? Where did the idea come from?
This is a very interesting project. It started about 6 or 7 years ago, and it went from the top level of echelons of the administrations trying to get DOE and NASA to work together for various reasons that are kind of lost in the midst of time. But it was like, at some point, essentially, I received a call asking me, Do you want to take part in a project to put radio telescope on the moon? And I said, why not? Like, this sounds like a very exciting opportunity.
So they called you up and said, we've got a spot for you to put your project on. You want to go?
Yeah, well, there was no project time. People just said, do you think interesting science could be had by putting radio telescope on the lunar far side? And at the time, we were kind of this thinking about putting a large telescope on the ground for kind of related science. But this sounded like there was funding, and basically there was a spot, and it's time to go. So I said yes, and I never thought I would be doing like a space mission in my life. But this is how science goes.
Are there other astronomers who are annoyed that you got to skip to the front of the line?
I mean, partly yes, because normally these projects start with the community processes, you know, these big surveys where kind of community comes together and decide what are the next big step. So if you want to kind of start a new project, you have to start kind of going around your colleagues, lobbying, and trying to convince them why they should be doing something. And this takes time and effort. And right. Well, this was kind of came out of nowhere. But frankly speaking, it's also a kind of relatively small project, right? It's not like big flagship projects that DOE often does. For me personally, the fact that it's small, it's been kind of really like a boon. I feel like a postdoc again. Like it's such a simple system. I can understand everything, and I can go and really kind of like develop low-level things without having to fight bureaucracy. But having said that, for somebody who spent their career doing stuff on the ground, like the psychology of sending something to the moon is just insane, right? It's just very difficult, this idea. Now you're done, you're going to put it in the box, and you're not allowed to touch it anymore. And if you messed up, well, you messed up. It's too late now, right? That's been new and kind of very, very difficult.
Well, you're the pioneer. You're the pioneer in this. Pioneer. Right?
We're the pioneers. Yeah.
Well, I wish you great luck, and please stay in touch because we'd like to know when this blasts off, and we'll keep track of it, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Anja Slosar is science lead for the Lucy Knight Project. He's based at Brookhaven National Laboratory out there on Long Island. After the break, why genetic mutations are the norm, not the exception in our bodies. Don't go away. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Right now, your DNA is mutating. Yes, yours. Well, and mine too. And no, I'm not giving you an early cancer diagnosis. Cancer and mutations obviously go hand in hand, but you may be surprised to know that our bodily systems are rife with mutations. These errors and attempts to repair them are a key to understanding immune function, aging, and even how heart disease develops. In fact, gene mutations can even mitigate the harm caused by some inherited diseases. My next guest is here to take us on a journey through the illuminating science of genetic mutations. Roxanne Camsey is a science writer and author of the new book, Beyond Inheritance, Our Ever-Mutating Cells and a New Understanding of Health. She's based in Montreal, Quebec. Welcome to Science Friday. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Ira. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you. Okay, you know, most of us think about our DNA as it's static, it's stable, kind of like a personal ID number. How should we be thinking about how our DNA changes over the course of our lives?
So I was taught the same thing. You know, I was taught that the DNA I inherited from my mother and my father is the same in all of my cells. And what I discovered about 8 years ago was that's not the whole picture, and that scientists right now are uncovering that each human body is a landscape of genetic diversity, and that our DNA is dynamic. It's not static. In fact, scientists estimate that if a person reaches 100 years old, a single white blood cell will have around 3,000 mutations that are not found in the rest of their body. So this is the new understanding of genetics I really feel is important, that our DNA changes over time.
Why are mutations so rampant then in our cells?
So part of this has to do with the fact that we are a collection of cells. We all start as a single cell for the first 24 hours after we're conceived. And then by the time we reach adulthood, we're around 30 to 40 trillion cells. And that's not counting the 30 trillion cells in our gut microbiome that are microbial cells. And there's a lot of turnover to maintain this mass of cells that we are. Every time a cell divides, it's trying to copy its DNA, and sometimes it makes errors. And when it does make errors, those mutations, those DNA mistakes, stick around in all the subsequent cells. And on top of that, there's just like regular wear and tear that happens inside the cells of our bodies. So right. DNA breaks, and when that gets fixed, sometimes errors are introduced there as well.
In your book, you use this metaphor of the mosaic to describe how our cells grow and change over time. Why mosaic?
So I think it's important to understand that the cell in my toe, for example, is not the same as the cell in my brain genetically. And I like the idea of having a mosaic in mind, because when we think about a mosaic, those pieces form a coherent whole. But when you look at them individually and compare them, there are slight differences. And I think that you can look at the human body the same way. Our cells are similar in that they're all working to make us, you know, sing a song or lift a spoon to our mouth. But at the individual level, there are differences, and some of those differences can be meaningful.
You know, when we think of genetic mutations that cause disease, I think we're often thinking about the ones that get passed down from our family tree, like Tay-Sachs or sickle cell. Is there a difference between inherited mutations versus the ones that develop over the course of our lives?
It's a really interesting question. And I think this speaks to why I wrote this book. I want people to understand that genetic disease is not always something that is inherited. It's something that can spontaneously develop in us. Now, if you inherit a mutation, say for sickle cell or cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs, that mutation is found in all the cells of your body. But if a spontaneous genetic DNA error occurs, it is only in some of the cells of your body, going back to that idea of mosaic. That being said, you can still develop a genetic disease that is full-blown if it develops early enough in your life. Also, if it develops later, but in an important cell, say in your brain, you could have a genetic disease that affects you profoundly. So we're talking about scientists now understanding that spontaneous DNA errors can cause epilepsy, autism. There's a long list of common diseases that can be caused by genetic errors that spontaneously occur.
Interesting. I think many of us are familiar with the term epigenetics, the idea that our environment, our life experience can have effect on how our genes are expressed. Is that different from the mutation you're talking about in our DNA?
Yeah, definitely. So when I tell people that I'm interested in this, they often ask, so are you writing about epigenetics? And
right,
I kind of have to shift their thinking, because I am interested in epigenetics. I write about epigenetics, but I really wanted to focus on the actual sequence changes that happen. So epigenetic markers sit on top of the DNA, but what I'm talking about here are actual changes to those 3 billion nucleotides that make up the human genome in each of our cells.
Yeah. Let's get into some specifics, if you might. You talked about the white blood cell before. You write about how blood cell mutations can lead to heart attack and stroke. I was kind of surprised that I had no idea mutations were at play here. What's going on?
Yes, definitely. This is one of the reasons I had to write this book, because I was shocked. I learned about this about 8 years ago when I read that in the New England Journal of Medicine, they had a brand new paper suggesting that mutant blood cells were not only linked to cancer, but in some people that had no cancer were doubling the risk of heart disease, stroke, all these cardiovascular diseases. And I was just shocked, because I'd never thought about mutation as causing these kind of diseases. It was completely new to me.
Right. Are these the kinds of mutations that happen spontaneously, or does our lifestyle contribute to these mutations?
So some of it happens to just be time. Like, over the course of our lives, we are more likely to pick up mutations that cause these large populations of mutant blood cells to start growing within us. And so by the time somebody is 70 years old, there's about a 10 to 20% chance that you have a substantial number of these mutant blood cells in your body. But there's also some interesting research looking at how things like getting good sleep might reduce your risk of these mutant blood cells rising in your body. And they've actually also tried to study what happens to astronauts in space, whether that extra radiation that they're exposed to might also contribute to their risk of these mutant blood cells.
How do mutations play a role in how the immune system functions?
I think this is one of the most provocative things I've learned. So we tend to think about mutation as something bad, right? We've talked about cancer, we've talked about all sorts of genetic diseases, but there is a necessity of mutation happening in our bodies. So if we don't mutate, we can't defend against the viruses and bacteria that try to infect us. People that can't mutate their immune cells have a disorder called hyper-IgM syndrome, and they're at extreme risk of opportunistic infections. They have a basically compromised immune system and require all sorts of treatments, bone marrow transplants. So we are very lucky, you and I are very lucky, that our immune cells mutate to defend ourselves against bacteria and viruses in our environment.
Mm-hmm. What about vaccines? Do they cause mutations of our DNA? This is one of the big anti-vax scare tactics. They will change your DNA.
Yes, they do change your DNA. So I want to back up for a second and say, even getting sick changes the DNA of your immune cells, because your immune cells are essentially playing the lottery. They're trying to figure out if they can rearrange their DNA, whether they can come up with a new antibody, a new kind of shape of antibody that will bind and neutralize that virus or that bacteria that's trying to make you sick. Now, with vaccines, we're essentially doing the same thing. We're trying to nudge the mutational patterns in the immune system in order to come up with an antibody, but to do so quicker, to give it a shortcut. So yeah, like a lot of people that are skeptical of vaccines or anti-vaccines will say, you know, these mutate your DNA. And I say, yes, it does. It's like somebody saying, you know, you're wearing an ugly dress. And I'm like, yes, I am wearing an ugly dress. And I did so on purpose. You know, I really like this pattern. But yeah, so we use vaccines in order to evolve our immune cells to make better antibodies.
Let's talk a bit about cancer, because we always associate cancer with mutations. How has our scientific understanding of how cancer changed as we've learned more about how it mutates?
Yeah, you could say our understanding has evolved, right? So we used to think about cancer as the result of one or two genetic errors. And that was kind of the pervasive thinking for a few decades. What recently has been shown is that cancers are just rife with mutations. There can be, in certain types of cancers, like colorectal cancers, for example, there's some theories that there's like a big bang of mutations that happens early on that just seeds a huge amount of diversity. So instead of thinking of a tumor as something that was the result of one or two genetic errors, we now think of tumors and malignancies as hotbeds of mutation. And the challenge then is to think about which of those mutations are driving the cancer and making it most resistant to treatment.
Yeah. And speaking of mutations not doing just harm, you write about how they actually can auto-correct some genetic disorders. How does that work?
So yeah, I want people to understand that we need a revolution in our understanding of mutation. And part of that is I want to destigmatize the concept of mutation. It's not always a bad thing. So back in the late 1990s, for example, scientists found that there were these two boys in the New York area that they were born with a type of immunodeficiency that they were supposed to live in a bubble essentially their whole life. And what they found, though, is that these two boys were defying any expectations. Their immune systems were doing much better than the scientists expected. And when they looked closely, they found that there actually had been mutations that these boys had acquired that had corrected their inherited disorder. And it's not the only example. So there's a disease called Fanconi anemia, and about 20% of people with that disorder actually start having blood cells that correct the disease that they have. And in 5% of those cases, they have enough that they start to progress towards just curing themselves. So it is like finding the answer within.
That is really, really interesting. We've talked on this show before about DNA changing as we age. Tell me how this mutation process plays a role in aging.
So as you and I are talking, as people are listening, our DNA is just picking up mutations, and some of these mutations will stick around for a while. And the idea is that by the time we're older, we've kind of just amassed a bunch of mutation. Now, the idea is, what happens if we might be able to undo some of the mutation that we acquire? And I know that on this show, you guys have talked about bowhead whales and how they have a vast amount of DNA repair enzyme. And this might be part of the reason they can live 200 years and longer. So the question is, can we maybe replicate some of the DNA repair in those long-lived organisms to improve our longevity as well?
Interesting. I know there's a huge anti-aging industry that is just itching to figure out the key to longevity and probably make a lot of money. Is this science at a place where we can identify the mutations that are responsible for aging? I mean, we all age, right? But what about the mutations that might be responsible for aging?
It is, yes, super tantalizing to think about this as a new avenue to anti-aging treatments. But as you're pointing to, there's a lot of hype in this industry that happens, and we want to make sure that we don't go too far in one direction without kind of having a reality check. I think the important thing to recognize is, as you and I have talked about, mutation can be a good thing. So if you try to globally slow it down, you might be doing a disservice to the body. You might be slowing down its ability to defend itself, perhaps.
Right, right. You know, I remember when the first human genome was sequenced in 2000. It ushered in a revolution in biology, but there was another technologic advance more recently called single-cell sequencing. Please explain what that is, and how did that shape our understanding of cell mutations?
For sure. So once you're able to look at the body at the single-cell level, you can really understand at a granular level which cells are mutating and which ones aren't, and you can really compare and contrast. If you really want to count, let's say, what proportion of cells have a mutation, that single-cell sequencing is super helpful.
How could this new understanding of mutations change how we understand human health, and what kinds of new treatments are possible?
So, you know, I'm not a huge proponent of things like smoking. And I was talking to my son's babysitter about why not to smoke. And then I was thinking about what I learned. And that's, if you smoke a cigarette, you have mutations that happen in your body. But now scientists can see, thanks to these technological advancements, that smoking a cigarette causes different mutations from, let's say, chewing tobacco. And I think what this points to is we're going to now be able to dissect how behaviors interact with our DNA at a whole new level. And also, so when we see a mutation has corrected an inherited disorder, we can go back and say, hey, can we develop a drug based on that mutation that can help other people that didn't spontaneously correct in that way? And we're finding that that actually is the path that some researchers are taking with liver disease already.
Hmm. Now, I know you've been writing about genetics and biology for a long time. Has writing this book changed how you think about the causes of illness and disease at all?
I definitely think that writing this book has changed how I think about genetic disease. So when I started my career, when people talked about patients with genetic disorders, there was a lot of othering, right? Like, they have a mutation, I don't have a mutation. I'm safe. I'm okay. It felt like people try to create space between those people with genetic disease and those people without. And what I've really come to understand is that we are all mutants, right? There's no othering. We all have a lot of spontaneity in our DNA, and who knows what kind of mutations we pick up. So I think it's kind of made me see a more universal process in our DNA. I think that's really what's changed in my perspective, if that makes sense.
That does, and it's very interesting, and I'm thanking you for taking time to be with us today, Roxanne.
Thank you so much. I have so enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Roxanne Kamzy, science writer and author of the new book, Beyond Inheritance, Our Ever-Mutating Cells and a New Understanding of Health. She's based in Montreal, Quebec.
And before we go to break, we're working on a story about the psychedelic ibogaine, which is illegal here, but has shown some promise for treating symptoms of traumatic brain injury and addiction and other conditions. And we want to hear from you. Have you used ibogaine medicinally? And if so, tell us about it. How did you learn about it? Why did you try it? And what was your experience like? Please give us a call. 877-4-SCI-FRI is our number, 877-4-SCI-FRI. After the break, how do you take a tiny, beautiful moment from nature and capture it in words? We're celebrating Earth Day with two poets. You don't want to miss it. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman.
Flora just asked me to leave a message about a special place.
I wanted to share one of my favorite places on the planet.
Calling about my place in nature that just fills my soul.
To mark Earth Day, we asked you to take us to your favorite places on this planet, and you brought us to the woods near Traverse City, Michigan.
I experienced the joy of the bird songs and the joy of the wind through the trees and the joy of the sun coming through the canopy of the trees. And it's literally magical.
You took us to Long Island Harbor, where you spent your summer as a kid.
It always smells briny, and the wind coming off from the sound is great. It just can feel like you're 1,000 miles away.
You took us to a lake in Oklahoma.
Every morning I walk my dog down this lane, and it's dark and it's quiet and there's no one anywhere. And every time I come upon this little hidden cove, there's some surprise.
If I go late in the day, it might be a gorgeous Grand Lake, Oklahoma sunset.
Basking in a sea breeze, admiring a sunset. I mean, these are basic human pleasures. But how do you take these moments and turn them into meaning? How do you pin them down with language? And how do you do it without sounding like a big cliche? That's my question. This is the very difficult job of my next guests. They're poets. Jane Hirschfield is the founder of Poets for Science, and Kimberly Blaser is the former Wisconsin Poet Laureate. Jane and Kim, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
It's a delight.
When you're doing what our listeners are doing, you know, capturing a place or a moment and then sort of doing this difficult work of turning it into a poem or writing, where do you begin?
So my process is, when I'm doing nature especially, is that I'm paying attention. I always say poetry is an act of attention. And so just looking closely, and especially at the intricate aspects. And as the one clip that you played mentioned surprise, it's allowing yourself to be surprised again. But also for me, it's a little bit falling into whatever is there and kind of letting go of my ego. So I think the experience is first and the poem follows on the tail of the experience. But when I go to that writing phase, it's often trying to get close to both the beauty, but also, as Jane suggests, the questions. Or for me, it's like getting to the edge of the experience of what can't be known, or what maybe language can't even touch, the ineffable. So as a poem, it wants also to invite the reader to that space, both to the space of experience and to the space of mystery.
Mm. Jane, this might be, I don't even know if this is too basic of a question, but how do you avoid the beautiful sunset trope? Like, do you ever find yourself falling into a cliche, or are you beyond that?
Well, I think one of the things that poetry teaches, if you read good poems and let them do their work upon you, is that there's always at least one stitch from the other side of the fabric. And that is how you avoid cliche and sentimentality. So if you look at any good love poem, somewhere in it, it is murmuring either explicitly or in a way that the reader hears, even if it's not directly said, "And we're going to die." And any poem of grief, any elegy, any poem of loss or even despair, if it is a good poem, there will be in that black surface a gold stitch of, "Ah, but the world was beautiful."
We asked our listeners, you know, to reflect on their favorite places, and we got this call from Christopher from Tampa.
In 1995, my mom and I did a cross-country trip for the first time from Florida all the way out to the desert Southwest. And when we drove into Zion, my young brain was just like totally blown away by this 2,000-foot crack in the earth that you come in from the bottom. And I just couldn't believe how beautiful this place was. And it's like time stands still there, like a natural wonder time capsule. And you'll remember the first hike you went on with your mom, and you'll be an old person, and you'll remember that same trail with those same cracks and crevices and petroglyphs and waterfalls and mirror pools. And they will kind of like lock you in. It's such a beautiful experience. So thanks for taking my call, and happy Earth Day.
Any feelings on that one?
Oh, it's marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. It is the kind of experience that profoundly alters a life, because listening to it in the context of this program, what I was hearing is the difference between recounting such an experience in prose, you're just telling it to somebody, and what would Chris have done if he were writing a poem? How would it have been different? Maybe you start with some of those specific things that he recounted seeing. I see this great opportunity. Early on, he spoke of the enormous crack in the earth, and there's so many directions that the mind and heart can go when they consider, you know, a crack is a place of opening. Ah. It is a place of revelation. It is a place where you see the geological strata of time. And it is also very much a metaphor for brokenness and for the fracturing of our lives. And I heard that and I went, there's so much you can do with that. So, you know, if he wished to write a poem, having had the experience, having captured it, those are some of the directions I would look. You start with the seeing, and then you find the thing that invites seeing differently, more, another direction, an additional direction. And in placing those things next to each other, it's like the spark gap in an old combustion engine car. It is the space that allows something new to come forward and move everything in another direction.
And also, that crack is the same crack that he experienced in his life. Like, he's on the other side, and it'll never be the same place again or vision once he's been through that experience. So I love the suggestion to use that as a metaphor.
Moving from that huge crack in the earth, Kim, you have a collection of poems about small things. Will you read us one of those poems and then tell us about it?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted. And I just want to say, to preface this, is that for me, I thought I was writing a series of poems, but I realized this is actually an aesthetic. It's a way of engaging with the world and the way of engaging with poetry. And so now I understand it more as that. And for me, it comes out of two different traditions. One of them is the Anishinaabe dream song tradition. And one of them is also haiku. And there are a lot of similarities between what I'm attempting in these poems and that, especially haiku in the Zen tradition. The way we love something small. Inky leaf shadows on snow, each animal track a hollow, trace of bird feet, double oval of deer, the glyphs we make, the ones we follow.
Beautiful.
Oh, I love Kim's specific and awakening language. And, you know, short poems have been written in every tradition all over the world. And so there's this interesting conversation between all the different ways that you can make a very short poem which opens into an immensity. And that is the work of the very short poem.
Kim, on this show, we're always talking about the purpose of science. And often the shorthand for that is, you know, discovery or creating new knowledge. What do you see as the purpose of poetry?
Well, poetry is also an investigation. It's a search. And it's for that idea, that experience, that detail that we don't know. And we kind of want to put ourselves against that and see what happens. You know, like, we keep, there is no end to it in the same way that there is no end to the research of a scientist, right? And I think it's, in my mind, it's to get to know that being or reality. Because I always think, as an Anishinaabe woman, of the world as animate and as a thinking, intelligent world. So I'm just trying to get to know my relatives in poetry.
Well, I would like to say that I agree with Kim entirely about the shared endeavor of science and poetry. And each of them is an art and a practice that concentrates the attention in order to observe and sometimes experiment, because poems are experiments in search of meaning. But the great difference for me between poetry and science is that we turn to science to face questions that we hope and believe are going to be answerable, at least provisionally for 50 years until the science changes. But we turn to poetry exactly in order to enter questions that don't have answers. Dilemmas of human life, perplexity, bewilderments, mysteries, radiances, for which there are no answer, but these are questions that require of us response. And the difference is that the response of a poem leads to what Robert Frost famously called a momentary stay against confusion. But the question is going to need answering all of our life. And so you need new poems, you need different poems, because you will continue to have the unanswerable questions and you want new answers to unanswerable questions. The poem is a way to say yes to existence in all of its perplexities and all of its difficulties and all of its joys.
Okay, I have one more call from a listener that I really want you to hear. This is from Susan in Pennsylvania.
I live in a lush green valley between two ridges in southwestern Pennsylvania. The land has been in my family since the early 1800s. My grandparents gave 30-some acres to my parents, who built a home on the side of the hill facing south, so the sun helps warm it in winter. This place is beautiful every season, but it's spring now, and every day we find some new delight. Trout lilies and cutleaf toothwort in the woods, spring beauties and violet sorrel dotting the grassy areas, dogwoods and redbud making a spectacular display. A chorus of birdsong greets us each morning, and we rejoice in the bluebirds who occupy the homes we've built for them. A barred owl calls in the night, and the eerie sound of coyotes echoes in the distance. Last summer, I watched the entire process as a monarch butterfly emerged from its chrysalis. Ironically, what makes this place more precious is the fact that we are increasingly surrounded by gas wells, and within the next few years will be undermined by longwall coal mining. There's a good chance we will lose our water and perhaps our home. By then, we will be too old to rebuild, and our adult children, though they love this place, are not in a position to give up their lives to move here when we are gone. So each day, even as we savor the beauty and marvel at our good fortune in living here, we feel the poignancy of impending loss.
Wow. That's so powerful. And it reminds me of a line from Basho, who wrote, "Even in Kyoto, I long for Kyoto." It's actually hearkening back to what Jane said earlier about that duality. And what's so heartbreaking and moving in this voicemail is that the person is offering us stunning images of a place they love so much and also are sitting in the foreknowledge of loss, which is the human condition, right? And I think that is where poetry can be of service.
Yeah, stitch from the other side of the fabric, right?
Yes. And I feel hearing that story, I feel the enormous grace and courage the speaker brings to reality and to knowing that whatever the future brings, whatever fracturing of the earth is going on right now, to still love this world, to still love existence, that is the antidote to despair. And there is a great, to use an old-fashioned word, gallantry, the gallantry of that description is that even in the face of not being able to change a loss that is coming, you love where you are, you love the beauty of this world, and that lets a person keep opening their eyes every day, that love, because otherwise we fall into despair.
Jane, will you leave us with a poem too?
I will. So I live in Mill Valley, a place on Mount Tamalpais, north of San Francisco, that was logged of all of its trees after the 1906 earthquake and fire. But redwoods come back from the roots. They are resilient creatures. So, tree. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life.
Beautiful.
I've been talking with Jane Hirschfield, poet, founder of Poets for Science, and author of The Asking, New and Selected Poems, and with Kimberly Blazer, poet and founding director of Indigenous Nations Poets and author of Ancient Light. Thank you both for sharing your thoughts with us today. It was really so delightful.
Thank you for giving us this time.
Thank you, Science Friday, for always including a bit of poetry during National Poetry Month each year.
Thank you both. I could talk to you both all day, and I did on our podcast. So if you want to hear more, please search for Science Friday wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you to everyone who called us with your stories. We loved going all over the world to hear about your favorite places. We really appreciate every call we got. That's about all the time we have for the show. We will see you next week. I'm Flora Lichtman.